You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture on the regionalization of Indian politics and the coalition of the challenge of coalition building. I mean, let me say that we start today a new lecture series which will focus mostly on Indian politics, not so much in the partisan sense of it, although this is definitely an inevitable part of the debate, but we'll try to focus on key issues which influence the dynamics that is underlying all Indian politics today, and that Christophe has once qualified the title of his book, The Silent Revolution. And there is a revolution indeed. I mean, the time of the dominance of the Congress is no longer there, with all sorts of consequences that we see election after election, which makes them increasingly difficult to read. Now, we start today with the theme of regionalization and its main consequences, coalition building, because as you all know, I mean, this has all become increasingly problematic in India. And the reason why we decided to start with this topic is that it has consequences not only on Indian decision-making domestically, but also on foreign policy. So this is not something which is a purely Indian matter. This definitely has consequences for India's foreign policy, both regionally and internationally. I should say also both positively and negatively. I mean, clearly what we see in Punjab today and the willingness of the Punjabi business community to interact with the Punjabi business community in Pakistan can be put on the positive side. I mean, question can be asked as to what we see in Western Bengal and the consequences for relation with Bangladesh and further with relation with Burma and so on and so forth. I think we could have no better guest today than Christophe Jaffrelot. Besides being a friend, Christophe is a non-resident scholar at Carnegie, which is also a plus, of course, but also a senior research fellow at the Center for International Studies and Research, CERI, in Paris. He also teaches in Sciences Po, in Columbia, Princeton, Yale, King's Indian Institute at King's College in London. I wonder when his students actually see him, because with so many teaching, you know, that may have been a problem.
They're not simultaneous assignments.
Thank you very much for the precision. But I mean, the person we welcome today is first and foremost the expert on international politics. As you all know, Christophe has written extensively, on the theories of nationalism and democracy, the mobilization of the lower caste, and Untouchables in India, and the Hindu nationalist movement. He also writes now regularly on ethnic conflict in Pakistan. In other words, he has a broad range of issues that he mastered wonderfully, and we're delighted to have him today. Christophe, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Frédéric, for having me today. And I think you shared some of my talks in Islamabad, in Delhi, but it's the first time in the Carnegie, so I'm very happy to not only to be here for this, but also to meet friends and students I've not met for at least 1 year. Well, this is indeed a very topical subject, and I would start by saying that already India has adjusted itself to the post-Congress era, and not without difficulty. In the 90s, you will remember that the era of coalitions has become domesticated. It took 10 years, if you remember well, between 89 and 99, India had 5 prime ministers, which meant 1 prime minister every 2 years. That was not very good. That was a very unstable moment. Small parties did not know how to behave properly, and they pulled the plug, they withdrew their support. Remember, for instance, the AIDMK of Federalita in 99, whimsically making Vajpayee's government fall. So to adjust to post-Congress logic took quite some time. And now here is a new challenge. It's not only post-Congress, it's not only the era of coalitions, it's also the era of coalitions, because of the rise of regional parties. So I will first try to analyze this trend And I will qualify it. I'll try to also somewhat relativize it and also look at the responsibility of the national parties in the world. And then I'll turn to the future of India's politics and the immediate future in a way, because elections are around the corner. What does it mean for Indian politics and Indian political economy? I'll highlight the economic dimension somewhat, because I think it's also very much part of this regionalization of politics. So first, the rise of these regional parties at the expense of the national parties. And I will begin with some paradox. There is definitely a rise of the regional parties. If you look at the electoral results, the Lok Sabha elections, I will not give you too many figures, because if I had a PowerPoint, it would be easier, but I don't want to give you too many figures. Just two figures. 91, the non-national parties, I prefer that, the non-Congress, neither BJP parties, represented 43.6% of the valid votes. 43.691. Last elections, 2009, 52.5. Almost 10 percentage points more. So a majority of the voters in India today do not support the BJP or the Congress, but support regional parties. And it was not the case before. There is a trend. There is a trend that paradoxically is not that detrimental to the Congress. And I'd like to make that point clear, because it's also pointing to the future. The same year when the non-national parties got this very large number of voters, the Congress could come back with the largest number of seats since 96. The Congress could get, with less votes, more seats. Why? Because of the regionalization of politics, partly. Because this phenomenon of regionalization means that in many states, the Congress is facing not one, but two regional forces. And in a system, the first past the post system, when the opposition vote is divided, you may have less votes than before, but you will have more votes than the others. So if you look at places like, I will not give you too many details, because there are 52 parties in parliament, so if I give all the acronyms, you will get lost. But just three examples. The Congress and the NCP, its allies, won all the seats in Bombay without having more votes. Why? Because the Shiv Sena got divided into two with the MNS of Raj Thackeray cutting into the votes of the Shiv Sena and the BJP. Similarly, in Tamil Nadu, a new player came, a Dalit party, and cut into the vote of the IADMK. And the IADMK lost many seats because of that. And that was at the benefit of the DMK, the ally of the Congress. Andhra Pradesh, a good film actor, could build a Kapu-based party that cut into the TDP base. Andhra Pradesh, the Congress lost many, many votes and win many, many seats. So the list could be longer. I don't want to be too long precisely on that front. But you see one thing there. There is indeed a process of regionalization, but the fragmentation of the regional parties themselves do help the only party that is national it may be sinking somewhat. It is not reflected in the number of seats it will get, which means that if the process continues, the Congress may still be there as the only surviving forces in the middle of this fragmentation. That's the first, I would say, qualification of the proposition the parties of the regions are developing at the expense of the national parties. There is one more qualification that I will make. Today, we consider that this process of regionalization is one of the root causes for the paralysis of the governments, of the governance of India. And at first sight, we blame the state parties, which are part of the ruling coalition or coalitions, for not playing the game that the government wants to play. There are many examples. Mamata Banerjee from the Trinamool Congress in West Bengal, not prepared to help Manmohan Singh to liberalize the economy. The retail sector is at stake. Or if you look at the reactions to Chidambaram's, the Home Minister, decision when he was Home Minister, to centralize the fight against terrorism. You know, there is this notion of a national anti-terrorist center. All the state parties almost were against that. So the temptation that we have is to say, well, there is a government in Delhi, and there are people who don't play the game, and they are the state parties, they are the spoilers of the policy-making process. Well, it's not wrong, but let's turn to the national parties. Aren't they responsible partly for the problems? And I think they are. And that's true for the Congress as well as for the BJP. On the Congress side, I think there are three clear problems. And I don't want to dwell on that because I'm sure you know them by heart. We have a prime minister who is not decisive enough. And the last reshuffle is one more illustration of the lack of political will is mastering. We have, secondly, a tension between the Prime Minister and the President of the party, Sonia Gandhi, which is now rather obvious. They are not on the same page on many issues. They are not on the same wavelength on many issues. If you look at the kind of government Sonia has created around herself, this advisory council, and when you look at the government of India, you see people whose ideas are geometrically different. When you add Archmonder and Aruna Roy, around Sonia, and Montek Ahluwalia as one of the advisors of Manmohan Singh, you could not be more poles apart. And they were explicitly, publicly poles apart. Think about the debate on the poverty line. Where is the poverty line? Well, Archmandir said, sorry, Mr. Montek Ahluwalia, you cannot live with 26 rupees a day in a village. He says, yes, you can. You should try. But it's a good example of the kind of tensions you have between two rather contrasted worldviews. And last but not least, where is Rahul Gandhi? Where is the leader of tomorrow? He was supposed in the government last week. He will not be probably a minister at all. Will he be a prime minister? Well, there is a leadership problem because of divisions, because of lack of leadership. And Rahul may not have it in him. You know, you're not born a leader. You may become a leader. You may never become a leader. The problem is that the Congress may wait till the last minute to realize that no, he's not fit for the job. But they will try till the last minute, probably, because there's no alternative. So when you look at all these problems on the Congress side, then you wonder, is the problem the allies of the UPA, or is the problem the lack of direction of the Congress? And I ask this question also because we did not face this kind of paralysis during the Manmohan Singh I government. And remember, at that time, there was one more player, which was quite an headache. When I met Manmohan Singh, he said, this is my daily headache. The Communist Party, he had to deal with the CPIM for 4 years. And he did. It did not create any paralysis. You had reforms, in spite of the Communist Party of India, Marxist, being part of the support base. So that's one more reason to wonder whether the problem is not the way the Congress is moving, rather than the way the allies are moving. If you turn to the BJP, you can certainly find many similarities. The BJP is also facing a crisis in terms of leadership. Where are the successor or successors of the Vajpayee and Advani of yesterday? They are still looking for this kind of amazing duo. You know, for 50 years, if you remember, well, you may not remember, 73. Many of you were not born, and I was hardly born. But 73, they started to work together, and they worked together for half a century, promoting the moderate face when Vajpayee was needed, promoting the hardliners face when Advani was more appropriate. And they played that till last elections, 73, 2009. Well, it's very difficult to replace this kind of duo. And they have no obvious successor. They have no obvious leader to take over. Arun Jaitley, Sushma Swaraj, Gadkari, not of the same caliber for sure. And this is reinforced by another problem, is that the BJP is not the master of its own destiny. Who has appointed Gadkari as president of the BJP? Not the BJP, the RSS. The man came from Nagpur and was appointed, well, against Advani's wish. And now they wonder, what is the right choice? And the BJP people could tell them, you see, you have a cadre, you have an RSS cadre, but we need a mass leader. And this man will not be a mass leader. So not only there is the problem of who after Advani and Vajpayee, but there is a problem of how will we negotiate with the other components of the Tsongkhapa River to get the right guy, which is an additional problem. And last but not least, the BJP is not at all a monolith. I would be tempted to say that it's a collection of state parties these days. And that's rather ironical when you think about the kind of pyramid it used to be, very centralized. And the best example of the emancipation of state leaders that you can find is Narendra Modi. Narendra Modi is not obeying to any order coming from Delhi, or from Nagpur, for that matter. He is following his own policy. He did not want Sanjay Joshi. Sanjay Joshi was sidelined. He wants his own foreign policy. He goes to Beijing when the Chinese have always been the enemy for the RSS. When you look at, for instance, the post-1962, it's quite some time ago, but writings by the RSS leader of that time, Golwalkar, the Chinese were really the threat. And this man goes to Shanghai and looks at the way deep sea ports are built and thinks, well, that would be good for Gujarat. That's not all the kind of partners the RSS and BJP people would like to have. So Narendra Modi is doing what he wants, and he's not reporting to the RSS or BJP leaders for that matter. On the top of it, if next month he wins again in Gujarat with a large margin, the BJP will have no choice. They will not be in a position to ignore him. They have nobody else. If the man really wins with a record number of seats, they'll have to consider him. And that will be one more problem. because then other partners of the NDA and the GDU of Nitish Kumar, to begin with, will say, no way, we don't want a Modi as prime minister in waiting on the NDA side. So the GDU will go, and the NDA, which is already shrinking, when you think of the NDA of 99 and the NDA of today they are left with six parties. There'll be five. And these GDU leaders may well turn to other state leaders to make a coalition of their own. So that's the first point I wanted to make. Yes, the state parties are on the rise, and there is a regionalization of politics, but that needs to be qualified from two points of view. First, the fragmentation that it means may continue to help the Congress that may survive by default. And two, the national parties are largely or partly responsible for the situation that we are facing today. Well, whatever the reason, the state parties are becoming more important. And now I would like to turn to the consequences that that may have for the future of politics in India. And that's where we need to factor the economic dimension in. You know, I will look at, I would say, the economic implications of the regionalization of India at large, and the political implications, secondly. Well, we cannot divorce the regionalization process in politics from the impact of liberalization on the economic front. You know, after 91, it was much easier for state governments to have their own policies. And we see now, after more than 20 years, that that has resulted in more disparities, in more diversity. Just a couple of figures. Again, I don't want to give too many, but just think about the fact that if you go by the NSS report of 2004-2005, and I'm sure the trend has continued, the richest state in terms of per capita GDP, Punjab, was 4.5 richer than Orissa. It's not the same India. They are living in different worlds, and I've taken rural states on purpose. If you compare an urban state, well, Delhi or Goa, and a rural state, you would see an even bigger gap. The gap is immense. In 1980, one more and last figure, Bihar, Uttar Pradesh, and Orissa, only three states, represented 37% of the Indian population living below this famous poverty line. 20 years later, they represented 46%. And today we know that the Bimaru states, the famous six states of northern India, represent 70% of the poor, when they represent only 40% of the population. So we could go on with these figures. If you travel to India, you know, just take the train in Bombay, Pune, Nasik, Nagpur, Varda, and you end in the cotton belt that is now the suicide belt. And you'd see that you travel from places where you have BMWs in the showcases to places where you have, nothing much. So we have disparities. We have also more competition, because in this situation, you see states fighting for having the right investments. And this competition has resulted in separate policies, economic policies. Now, if you compare, for instance, and I don't want to give too many case studies because that would take us too far, but if you compare Andhra Pradesh and Kerala, in Andhra Pradesh, you've had what I would call a structural adjustment. Naidu, when he was chief minister in the 90s, had a real, I would say it's kind of IMF policy. He had a real structural adjustment program. He reduced the subsidy for rice. He discontinued the free supply of electricity to farmers. He froze the hiring of civil servants. So he downsized the state. That's not something Kerala could do. That was just not possible. Kerala, you have strong unions, powerful unions, and when 500,000 civil servants went on strike, they had to give up because that was a state of paralysis. And also, interestingly, you had regional capitalists in Andhra Pradesh. And you see, that would be a very interesting research to do, by the way, to look at the regional capitalists of India today. You have the mines, the Baron mines, the Reddys. You have so many people who have really a regional base, but a strong base. Well, there is nothing like that in Kerala, where you have mainly SMEs, and if there was no remittances flow, Kerala would be in a complicated situation. So what we see is not only a divergence in terms of results, in terms of inequalities, in terms of per capita GDP, but a divergence in terms of policies. And hence, my last point, the political implications that may have, not in the short run, but possibly in the long term, in a longer term perspective. It's quite possible that the winners of that game, and you can have a long list, Andhra Pradesh, probably, Karnataka, probably, Gujarat, for sure, Haryana, at one point of time, we'll want more autonomy for being even more able to have their policy. Because at the moment, it's not so easy. The Constitution of India is a centralizing constitution, if you look at the text. It's not a constitution that gives so much power, autonomy to the states. You know, I've written to the Union list, state list, and concurrent list. Very interesting. It is the same list for now 65 years, and the union list give to the center many, many items, 97 items, including, I'll return to that, the main taxes. The main taxes are levied by the center. And the state list, which is made of 66 items, has many expenditures and no taxes, almost, to cope with these expenditures. You know, education, local administration, this is, well, expensive. And the concurrent list, where you have 47 items, is interesting also. That's where you have the labor laws. Important. But there is a provision, this is Article 246, that says in case of conflict on the concurrent list, the center will prevail. And there are two interesting other articles in the list of the state's prerogatives saying that the industry, especially the industry, will remain in the arms, in the responsibility of the center. Well, of all these provisions, the most important ones are the ones regarding the taxation policy, you know, the fiscal policy. You know, we are in a system where the states are depending upon the center for getting some money. They can't do with the taxes they levy. And there is a finance commission that is there for redistributing this money. So far, the kind of decisions this commission makes are rather not disputed. But lately, we saw a new problem. The state, the center, had to cut into its expenditures a great deal. And therefore, the money that was going to the states diminished, and the states have become much more indebted than before. Most of the states are running into very heavy debts. Now, the worst is UP, but you know, some of these states just can't pay their friends, their civil servants every month the way they should. So the rich states are supposed to pay for the poorer states, and it's just a speculation. But I would not be surprised if eventually there is a demand for some reform, for some amendment to the Constitution, making it much less centralized and allowing the states to collect taxes they need. So if I can conclude in, can I take 2 more minutes? Yeah, just 2 more minutes to say that in fact, if we write up, there may be 2 problems, and again, some of them are more short-terms and short-term problems, and others are more in the longer term, in the longer run. Certainly, coalition politics may be more complicated in the near future, even if the Congress is a survivor, with all the caveats I have mentioned. What we cannot rule out is a third force made of state parties who would have joined hands. And if you add up all these parties, RJD, RGDU, BJD, TDP, DMK, the acronyms are many. Well, you can reach the 272 seats. That is the magic figure. So that's the first challenge that probably the national parties can cope with if they put their house in order. And I would really put the blame, so to speak, equally on both sides, because I think the national parties are really also responsible for the situation. And in the longer run, well, I can just repeat what I've just said. I would not be surprised if the growing disparities in socioeconomic terms in India eventually results in some demand for more federalism, especially fiscal federalism. And that will be a problem, because what will be at stake at that time will be national cohesion, national unity. I don't know how they can really adjust to demands like that if they come from the rich states. But you know, the trend is really there. I gave figures of 2004 and 5 because that's the last very reliable NSS figures. But I'm sure the trend has continued. When you look at the Gini coefficient also, it's the same. The Gini coefficient has literally exploded in India. So these inequalities, which are there socially, are also there geographically. And the ruling coalition, not the party, will have to cope with that, whoever it is, not only after the next elections, but probably in a longer perspective. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christophe, for this overview of the Indian political scene. I mean, we have now about 45 minutes for a Q&A session. So whoever wants to take the floor will have it. Please introduce yourself, and the floor is yours. Yes, please, Josh.
Thanks, that was a really great presentation.
You have a mic just next to you.
I'm Josh White. I'm a Council on Foreign Relations Fellow in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. I wanted to ask about how you see the implications of these trends in regionalism toward India's foreign policy, both regionally and then a bit more broadly. And I'm particularly interested in policy towards Sri Lanka, Burma, but then also toward the United States. Are there any broad brush trends you could talk about in terms of ways that this might constrain or shape the direction of India's foreign policy decision making?
Please go ahead.
Well, thank you for this, yes, important question. I don't think I would put Sri Lanka and the US in the same league. So the response can only be somewhat nuanced. I think the US will remain in the portfolio of hopefully New Delhi and South Bloc. But, well, let's begin with that. At the same time, the Gujarati diaspora in the US plays a role also, kind of pressure group, kind of lobby. So you can't rule out that some state decision-making process using this channel can result in some rapprochement. But frankly speaking, that's marginal, I would say, compared to, Shiv Shankar Menon meeting Mrs. Clinton still. Sri Lanka, of course, here you have another kind of diasporic transnational link. Interestingly, even the DMK looked the other side when the LTT was crushed, and Karanidhi had a kind of token fast for a few days in terms of solidarity for the Tamils, but that's over. You know, this is something arcing back to the murder assassination of Rajiv Gandhi. The fact that Rajiv Gandhi was assassinated in Tamil Nadu in 91, probably by LTT people who had been welcomed by the Tamil Nadu government, make this complicity now impossible. Burma, I don't know. I think that it will also be something New Delhi will have to concentrate on, because it's very highly political, and China is there, so it's not only regional. But China, I think we have not paid sufficiently attention to Narendra Modi's visit to Beijing. Here is a new development. And he went there against the will of New Delhi, which was quite remarkable. So that's why now we hear some of our diplomats saying, you know, we don't let Narendra Modi coming to the West, so he's going to the East. You are pushing him in the arms of China. Yes, but can we also forget about what happened? You know, it's not our assessment, it is the judiciary of India was put behind the bars, ministers of Narendra Modi. We have not invented anything. So there is some guiltiness somewhere, and we can't brush that aside.
Yes, Milan?
Thanks. Milan Vaishnav here at Carnegie. Thank you, Christoph. That was really, really exceptional presentation. So I wanted to ask you on this issue of competition among the states. So I think one thing you often hear is when there's slowdown, when there's policy paralysis, we can rely on the states to have this competitive pressure with one another and kind of push forward in the governance envelope. At the same time, you hear that voters in India are increasingly rewarding good governance and economic performance, which I think is an open question, but there are signs of trend in that direction. My question is, you know, given that, why is there actually so little policy diffusion among states? You know, I think a lot of people thought, based on the lessons of Nitish Kumar and various reforms he put into place in Bihar, that the new government in next door in Uttar Pradesh would look over and say, we have something to work with. There's a template, and it seems to have been politically successful. And at least what we've seen so far, you don't see very many signs of that learning. And, you know, there are lots of other examples. Could you talk a little bit about why we don't see that kind of dynamic competition and learning given those sort of realities?
Yes, no, that's a very good question. And indeed, I would like to underscore the point you've made in your first comment. Yes, the voters are rewarding good governance more and more, and that's the ray of hope. I mean, for the whole picture, and Nitish Kumar is indeed the good example, because this is the only state, in fact, which is now growing at the same pace as Gujarat. It is doing very well. And who would have anticipated that? Because after 15 years of Rabri Devi and Lalu Prasad Yadav, we did not think that Gujarat, that Bihar could do so good, so well. And it does. It is doing. It is catching up. So why are not the others doing the same? I think that's where I would say two things matter a lot. First of all, the competence, sense of responsibility, whatever you call it, of the chief ministers. For me, West Bengal is a case in point. Now, in West Bengal, you have probably one of the best finance minister you could ever have. The man has been at the helm of the FICCI. He knows the capitalist milieu of India very well, but he can't do anything. And he's saying it because Mamata Banerjee has a different populist agenda, and she prefers to capitalize on that against the center instead of really trying something different. And Mayawati, in a way, did the same. With another problem, and that's the second dimension, you have also the tendency to wait for the money to come from the center and distribute it, preparing for the next elections. That's what we saw with the NRHGA. You know, the NRHGA was a very problematic program for that reason. The center wanted to give it directly to the people. First of all, because that would have meant less leakages, and that would have meant that, yes, we are, the Congress is giving you this money. And all the state governments said, no, it has to come through this channel that is the state government. So instead of, I would say, fixing their things and mending their ways, they were still waiting for money flowing from the center and distribute that. There is the kind of Ma-Bap syndrome, some kind of assistance. And the center indeed has bailed the states out repeatedly and has given this big program. That's a new development, by the way. You know, we did not add so many billions of rupees flowing from the center. And the states, instead of reforming themselves, wait for these billions to come and distribute them and think that they will win elections by being the ones who give the money instead of being the one who collect money. Because, of course, collecting money is... That's all the irony with the taxation of the rural sector. None of the chief minister of India is taxing the peasants the way they should, the way he should. It's like in Pakistan and in many other ways. By the way, the tax to GDP ratio in India is very similar to the tax to GDP ratio in Pakistan. There is a kind of a regional problem there. You know, it's not so bad in India, but it's much below what it should be. So it is. I would say it is related to the previous factor. You don't want to be unpopular. You want to be popular, waiting for the money to flow from the center and distribute it. And hopefully, if Nitish Kumar is re-elected once again, and if he becomes Prime Minister of India, that will change.
Well, Nicolas, please.
Thank you. Nicolas Blarel, doctoral candidate at Indiana University. My question is, you talked about the erosion of national support for national parties, but what about the erosion of our support in regional elections, which is even more important? So you have those old national parties now playing second, if not third fiddle in regional elections, and they're stuck in that sort of lower level game when they have to pick an alliance at the regional level, and then they're sort of locked in national elections with this ally they chose at the regional level. And this is where the regionalization of in politics is more important, because they tend to be locked in with those allies that they maybe didn't have really the luxury of choosing when they're at the regional level elections, and they're locked with them at the national level in those big coalitions. So I wanted to know what your impression on this kind of a locked mechanism at those two levels of elections. Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Indeed, you have not only coalitions at the center, but coalitions at the state level, more and more. But it's not such a new development when you think about it. And I would say that there is a kind of stabilization. You know, today, if you look at the map of India, you still have something like 2/3 of the states which are run either by the BJP in coalition or alone, or the Congress in coalition of or alone. Well, it's not so different from what we had, I would say, 20 years ago. That has to be checked. But because both parties realized very early on that they needed local interpreters, that they needed, as Diplo Kerviraj says, vernacularizers, you know, people who would translate their idiom into the regional language. Think about the Dravidian parties and the Congress. The Congress resigned itself to be out of Tamil Nadu as early as the 60s and decided to have one or the other as a partner, DMK or DMK. Think about the BJP. The BJP knew that it would not play more than second fiddle to the Akali party in Punjab, the Shiv Sena in Maharashtra. And that's, you know, the Shiv Sena BJP coalition arcs back to 84. So there is a kind of, I would say, stabilization of this, but that needs to be qualified from two points of view. First of all, for many decades or many years, the National Party was in the driver's seat. And now the state party is in the driver's seat. No. Bihar is a case in point. The BJP needs the GDU much more than the GDU needs the BJP, frankly. And secondly, and that's what you suggested also, we have reached sometimes an amazing situation where parties which were allies or partners at the center were adversaries at the state level. And that makes the whole equation of policy making really complicated. That happened repeatedly over the last 15 years. I would say outcome of that is that definitely the state parties have more leverage to extract from the center something for their state. That for sure.
Yes, madam.
Hi, Snigdha Deval, PhD student at George Mason University. Thanks for the awesome presentation. I wanted to know if you could talk a little about the trends you see in terms of corruption and rent seeking. There's like a major civil society movement to counter corruption in India. So do you see regionalism playing some role in terms of state bodies trying to reform at the governance at the state level, or will they learn from some of the bad practices that have gone on at the center and corruption will just become fragmented and, you know, trickle down to the regional level?
Well, that's indeed one of the issues, and I'm sure in your series you'll have one of the sessions concentrating on corruption in itself.
We have a program dealing mostly with corruption.
I was about to say that Milan is the right person for that. Not because he's corrupt, but because he isn't uncorruptible. two things. For me, it's neutral. You know, the regionalization of politics is not aggravating significantly corruption. You hear that sometimes. Oh, it's because, you know, we have new parties, low caste parties. They need to earn money because they are really poor, and it's now or never. Frankly speaking, when you look at the big cases, historically and even now, historically, the first mobilization against corruption that India really knew was 73, 74, the JP movement, and that was against corruption. That was against LN Mishra, who was killed soon after, the right-hand man of Indira Gandhi. And it was Gujarat, it was Bihar, and JP is the role model for Anna Hazare, clearly, and some people think he is of that caliber. Let's see. But I think there is nothing new there. And that was the Congress at that time. If you look at who is guilty of corruption today, not state parties more than national parties. Think of the big cases again. Of course, you had the Fodor scam, Lalu Prasad Yadav. But you had Sukram, who had a puja room full of rupees. And that was given by ATT, Siemens and Co. That was much more money. So, and he was a congressman, and he remained a congressman, and he was re-elected as a congressman, because corruption doesn't end your career. Look at the Avala case. Six ministers, Madhav Rao Sindhya, Kamal Nath. Look for someone who is corrupt. It's at the Congress party. The Sanjay Brigade, the 70s, legacy of the emergency. Really, you can't say that it's more because you are from a state party than because you are from a national party that you're indulging in corruption. I think it's a disease that is everywhere, pervasive to the core. And the saddest part of it is that it's not Kejriwal who will fix it, because it's not a new party that can make a difference, even if it is supported by the RSS. Because that may be the end result of the process. No, it has to come from the inside. It has to come from the parties, I mean, whatever they are. And that will take a long time, because the trend is not going in the right direction, because the more money you have, the more corrupt you are. Because what has changed compared to the 70s is the amount of money. Now, when the 2G case is a $38 billion case, when the recent Colgate is $33 billion, then there is no comparison with the cases of even Beaufort's, peanuts, pocket money. So that has changed. But it's not because of state bodies. It's because of new multinationals coming in or being there and paying for new things, licenses and so on.
Madame in the back, and then we'll come back to Amvi.
Good afternoon, and thank you so much for the presentation. I'm Diane Farrell. I'm with the U.S. India Business Council, and we have certainly seen our share of frustrations with central level, either decision-making or lack of decision-making, and so we are very interested in those states that have a more progressive attitude when it comes to attracting foreign investment. So a year ago, almost exactly to the day, the central government decided to open up multi-brand retail, only to rescind the decision about 10 days later. But I think it's an interesting political phenomenon that to come back, effectively they offered enabling opportunities to states who choose to bring in multi-brand retail. The question I actually have is regarding the GST. because that would also be, that's at least, it's been a central concept in terms of unifying a collection of revenues, and the states would have to agree to participating. I gather on a constitutional basis, if I understand it correctly. I wondered if you could comment on where you see the state of play as it relates to the idea of a GST, and then how that would reflect in terms of some of the behaviors and activities, as evidenced by multi-brand retail as an example, from the states. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a bit technical for the political scientist I am, but I'll give you my assessment. First of all, on the retail, I do think that this time it will happen. Yeah, I do think it will happen because the crisis is deeper than 1 year ago, and they are desperately looking for investments. Money is flowing out of India these days, not flowing in India. And the main corporate people buy European companies rather than invest in the country. They don't trust the government of today, which is, and they say it openly. So, well, for the states where these companies are, to have, well, Walmart, Carrefour coming in, I think they are realizing that it can bring some relief. On the GST thing, I think that, and it's rather reconforting in some ways, they know that they need to modernize the whole thing. And, you know, for instance, they know that at one point of time, you will have to have accounts to get the accounts really right. Because many companies do not have. And when you have VAT, when you have these kind of things, you need to get your accounts right. So that's something they will do. And it's a very important development because it's probably the prerequisite or the precondition for a more modern fiscal policy. What I don't know is what the new finance minister of India has in mind for that. Because, you know, it's very important to have a good man at that post. And we don't know really that he'll have 2 years only before. But I've not seen anything, because he will be also coordinating this reform. That's something to watch, yeah, or even to ask.
Tandi.
Tanvi Madan, I'm a fellow at Brookings. Couple of questions. One on your point on the Congress needing to put its own house in order. The other aspect that kind of, if you compare UPA 1 and 2, was, somewhat of a failure to manage the coalition, to have an enforcer, to have somebody actually consult with the parties, which they did almost because they had to and were aware that they had to with the communists, but seem to have kind of left off in the last couple of years. Have you seen a sense of learning, partly because of the need, as you said, to get stuff done now? Has there been any learning? Have you seen any of these mechanisms or consultations, kind of pre-policy formulation consultations, rather than telling people after the fact and asking them to buy in, not just with the coalition, but also bringing the opposition party in, especially because if you look at it, at the end of the day, the two national parties in some ways have more in common on many of these policies, especially reform initiatives. The second question is, you call the BJP a collection of state parties, which is interesting.
It's a bit excessive, I agree.
I haven't heard it formulated that way, but I was just wondering, do you think in some ways that's going to be an advantage for them in the medium term, at least? Because on the one hand, one could say that, think of the, because of the politics at the national level, especially related to the family and succession not being quite clear, is that at the moment the Congress is like a banyan tree. Nothing is allowed to grow underneath. And so they don't have a second generation of strong leadership that has executive experience, whereas the BJP has a set of state leaders that gives them a bench, whether it's Shivraj Singh Chauhan or Narendra Modi or eventually Vasundhara Raje Sindhya, that in the medium term, this bodes well for them versus the Congress, where it's that succession plan beyond the Rahul Gandhi is not quite clear.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I'll begin with the last question. Yes. For a long time, we thought that the BJP would be more disciplined, would be, easier to mobilize behind one person. And now, I would say that factionalism has reached rather unprecedented proportions. And that was not the case before, really. State leaders being also faction leaders in many ways. You know, Vasundhara Raje and Narendra Modi do not see eyes to eyes for sure. They would not share easily a kind of platform. And secondly, for a long time we thought that the RSS will be, in any case, the last resort kind of arbiter and would put everybody on the same page. Again, there is a kind of downward trend because they did not do the right choice with Gadkare. They took the lead and they gave to the party someone who cannot be a prime minister for India, obviously. So the kind of credibility they had is diminishing. If they continue to push this man, and if Narendra Modi wins with a large margin, he'll say, the hell with you. I think he would. Because the man is now, matured enough. If he really wins again, and if the party promotes a candidate who cannot win, he will be well-funded to say, you just want me out, you don't want to win, that's all. And he has a large constituency. We should not underestimate the constituency of Narendra Modi all over India, the middle class. The urban middle class would certainly largely support him. So, again, one more division. On the other hand, I would say the Congress, with all its deficiencies that we know by heart, has one asset, a rallying point. And it is there. It is weak. It is not as decisive that it used to be. But till Sonia Gandhi is there, nobody will leave the party. The moment the family goes, that's the catastrophe. And you remember the Narasimha Rao years. When Narasimha Rao was Prime Minister of India, Sharad Pawar, Arjun Singh, Andy Tiwari, Madhav Rao Sindhya, everybody went. And they were left with 140 seats. So they were running after her. They were longing for her to come. And after so many years, she said, yes, that was 99, and the beginning of the Reconquista, because they all came back. They all came back, except in the Sharad Pawar, who was very nasty because he doesn't want to support the Italian lady. But he's around. So on the Congress, there is still someone that is sticking them together. The problem is that the next generation is not coming forward the way it should. And maybe after one divorce, not the brother, but the sister would do the job. Who knows? That's what we are waiting for in India. That's the way Indian politics is made up, with South Asian politics. Yeah, that's the family kind of politics. Your first question was, yes, about managing the coalition. I think Sonia is the one who is. If you look at the way the Congress resigned itself to coalition politics, it was not easy for a party that has been dominant for so many decades to say, yes, we will never rule alone again. And if you remember well, the first time she said, we have to embark on the coalition mode, it's after the GNK, Jammu and Kashmir election, when she accepted to be a junior partner in a PDP-led government. And she said, that will be our mode, because there is no other way. We will not rule alone, even at the center anymore. And when the UPA coalition was created, she was the one who was talking to the communists. You know, Manmohan Singh could not. He could, but I think she was much more political, and she was much more on the left. You know, she's a European after all, as so many CIA people would tell you. The welfare state is her cup of tea, you know. I think she's still doing it, with some fatigue probably, because, you know, after so many years of putting everybody, I mean, on the same pages. But the question is they have not lost anybody, in fact. The UPA is intact. The NDA is not intact. The NDA has lost many supporters. So, again, we are back to the family.
Another question beyond the family. Madam, please. We're changing side.
Hi, I'm Samira Sayed. I'm actually a graduate student from Johns Hopkins SAIS. I was actually wondering and hoping you could comment on an argument made by Irfan Nuruddin. He published a book last year that was on coalition building and economic development, and he actually argues kind of against the grain that coalition building acts as a stabilizing force in that it discourages bad decision-making, kind of encourages investment, and curbs economic volatility. So I was hoping you could comment on that.
Well, that's something, of course, you need to document on the basis of correlations and statistics, and I've not done it. But, the first point that I would support is that it has been a stabilization factor. In fact, now coalition governments last 5 years at the center and in the states. And if you compare that with the 80s, when the president's rule was used repeatedly and the government did not last sometimes more than 2 years, yes, it has not been at the expense of stability. And I can't think of coalition governments falling because one of the partners withdrew its support before the 5 years terms. I can't think about anything of that kind in the last 10 years, in fact. So stability is there. Now, is it good for reform in the sense that it brings everybody on board and therefore it's more, I would say, it's widely shared. It's a kind of accepted by large numbers of interest groups. It's very difficult to say because you can have, it depends what you mean by reform, really. If you think in terms of, for instance, positive discrimination reforms, which are not really economic, but which are certainly socio-economic. That was a bone of contention between the BSP and the SP when they were in coalition, for instance. In terms of economic reforms, it's true that the governments which have been the most active in terms of reforms, the BR government, for instance, is a coalition government. And on the contrary, the Trinamool Congress government in West Bengal, even though it's a monolith, has not done any reform. So, yes, the correlation may be right. It's interesting. It's a good point. I'll read the book.
Next question. Well, apparently Christophe exhausted the audience before the audience actually exhausted the question. So, well, if there are no more questions, I think we'll bring this session to a close. I'd like to thank you all for coming here today. I'd like to thank Christophe for his time. I mean, it's a sort of marathon that he's doing today. He was actually launching his last book just in Georgetown, just before coming here. So we are even more grateful that he has accepted our invitation. On those notes, I'd like to thank you all. Please join me in thanking Christophe for his performance.